Post reporter's home and took her computers as it investigates a leak. First Amendment lawyers call it an escalation in President Trump's war on the press. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Videos from Minnesota show ICE agents stopping people and asking where they're born. Agents also tell people it's illegal to follow them. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What are the lines federal officers are not allowed to cross? Also, Kristen Stewart says there's no reason avant-garde films can't be commercial hits. She talks about adapting a memoir for her feature debut as a director. It is Thursday, January 15th. On this day in 2009, a U.S. Airways jet became disabled after hitting a flock of geese shortly after takeoff. Captain Sully Sullenberger was able to land the plane safely, a feat that became known as the Miracle on the Hudson. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. France and Germany say they'll send troops to Greenland to join a joint military exercise with other European nations. This comes as President Trump repeatedly insists the U.S. needs Greenland. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the exercise is meant to show support to Greenland and Denmark.
The exercise will take place through Saturday. It's prep for possible military support to Greenland and to buttress security in the region. The latest meeting between the foreign ministers of Denmark and Greenland with Trump officials produced no resolution to escalating tensions around the ownership of the territory. In a communique, the European Parliament unequivocally condemns the Trump administration's statements regarding Greenland, saying his talk constitutes a blatant challenge to international law and the sovereignty and territorial integrity of a NATO ally. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
A Trump administration official has confirmed to NPR the administration is reversing $2 billion in cuts to mental health and addiction programs. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
An administration official with direct knowledge of the decision who asked NPR not to be identified because they were not authorized to speak publicly said all the grants are being restored. Hannah Wesolowski with the National Alliance on Mental Illness said care providers faced chaos and confusion.
After a day of panic across the country, nonprofits and people with mental health conditions are deeply alarmed, but hopeful that this money is being restored.
The decision to terminate the funding was reversed after the Trump administration faced bipartisan pushback. Brian Mann, NPR News, Washington.
Three more Democratic members of Congress say the Justice Department is investigating them over a video that they released last year. This video told members of the U.S. military to refuse illegal orders. The three representatives are Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania, Maggie Goodlander of New Hampshire, and Jason Crow of Colorado. Michigan Senator Elissa Slotkin announced yesterday she's also being investigated. Congressman Crow says none of the group will be silenced.
We took an oath to the Constitution, a lifetime oath, when we joined the military and again as members of Congress. We are not going to back away. Our job, our duty, is to make sure that the law is followed. We will not be threatened, we will not be intimidated, and we will not be silenced.
One of the lawmakers who participated in the video, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, is suing Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. There'll be a court hearing today in Washington. Kelly, a retired Navy captain, says the Pentagon is wrongly trying to demote his military retirement rank over free speech rights. President Trump will meet Venezuela opposition leader Marina Corina Machado today at the White House. He has said Machado does not have enough support to govern Venezuela. This is NPR. The United Nations Security Council is set to hold an emergency meeting today on the deadly protests in Iran. More than 2,000 people have been killed, according to human rights groups, as they protest the authoritarian regime. In the U.S., federal investigators say the same airplane part that broke on a UPS cargo jet last year also failed four previous times. NPR's Joel Rose reports last year's crash in Kentucky killed 15 people.
The National Transportation Safety Board says Boeing warned plane owners in 2011 about a defect in a certain part. But at that point, the plane manufacturer did not believe it was a threat to safety. Investigators say the same part, which helped secure the plane's engine to the wing, failed again on the MD-11 cargo plane that crashed in November. The planes were built by McDonnell Douglas, which was later bought by Boeing. The NTSB has not yet said what caused the plane's engine to fly off as it rolled down the runway in Louisville, but it appears that investigators are focused on the failure of key parts of the engine mount. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Four astronauts returned safely to Earth this morning from the International Space Station. They were in a SpaceX capsule. They splashed down in the Pacific Ocean just off California. NASA officials decided to bring the crew home a few weeks early. One of the four crew members has an unidentified medical condition. That condition is considered stable. The crew member was not named, but NASA says the entire team is in good shape. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
In today's world of on-demand media streaming over the internet, one has to wonder, why does traditional radio still matter? I'm Steve Noy, IT and broadcast engineer for KAXC. Why do we work so hard to offer traditional broadcasting when people can just jump on the internet and get instant access? Well, here's why. KAXE is available to everyone in our listening area, no matter your financial or social status. Anyone with a radio can hear KAXE, and you get the same great experience whether you're a member, a business sponsor, or just hearing about us for the first time. We do stream on our website, but it doesn't take a costly internet connection to hear KAXE. That's why we're looking for your help. We serve the whole community, and we can't do that without you. Tell others about us or text the word donate to 218-326-1234. KAXE is an equalizer, making great content available to you no matter who you are. KAXE is people-powered radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Some media executives are calling the FBI search of a reporter's home an alarming intrusion into the freedom of the press.
That search of a Washington Post reporter's house happened on Wednesday as part of the Trump administration's investigation of a leak.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us. David, all right, load us down with some details.
Well, as the Washington Post itself has reported, this stems from the government's case against a contractor named Aurelio Perez Lugones. He was charged in Maryland by federal authorities with unlawfully retaining national defense information. The Post reporter involved is Hannah Natanson. Her home yesterday morning in Virginia was searched. Law enforcement agents seized two computers, one of which was her own personal computer, her Garmin smartwatch. She's been dubbed by a colleague at the Post the federal government whisperer over the course of the past year. She's really documented the purge of hundreds of thousands of federal employees, completely reshaping the federal workforce. And last month, she wrote this first-person story about this process, how depleting it was, but how fulfilling the mission was. And she said she relied on 1,169 confidential sources, people whose lives were upended. Yesterday, over the course of the day, the executive editor, Matt Murray, wrote about the profound concerns about this. He said the institution was standing behind her and encouraged reporters to do their constitutionally protected duties, that is, to report. There were also strong statements from the publisher and from the editorial page as well.
Okay, so what does the government have to say about this?
Well, according to the Washington Post, the government has told the newspaper that Natanson is not a focus of the investigation. But I will say once news got out, FBI Director Kash Patel posted on X that Natanson allegedly had obtained and reported, quote, classified sensitive military information from a government contractor, endangering our warfighters and compromising America's national security. And that's stern stuff. He's focusing the attention on what she did as opposed to what the person, the contractor that they have charged allegedly with having held on to this information illegally, what he did. Now, there are protections for journalists against prosecutors on both the federal and local level, just rooting around in reporters' records to figure out where leaks came from. But there are exemptions, including for national security. And that's obviously what federal authorities, including the attorney general, are pointing to right here.
Okay. And why are press advocates alarmed by all this?
Well, first off, this is highly unusual and considered incredibly aggressive to search a reporter's home instead of going to the office, and particularly instead of giving a subpoena to allow employers, news organizations to comply or to fight that. I talked yesterday to a bunch of media executives and First Amendment lawyers, and I think that what they felt in some was encapsulated by the former executive editor of The Washington Post. That's Marty Baron. Here's what he had to say.
There's a whole pattern in this administration of trying to undermine an independent press in this country and impede their work one way or another.
And why would he say that? Well, the pattern includes lawsuits filed against the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, ABC, CBS, the BBC by President Trump as an individual. His top broadcast regulator has launched investigations of CBS and PBS and NPR and NBC. There's been pressure of the corporate owners of CNN, The Washington Post, and CBS. President Trump himself has repeatedly called for journalists who won't reveal their sources to be threatened with jail. And one more thing. Given what Nathanson wrote last month and all those 1,169 confidential sources, is this only about Perez Lugones, or is this a fishing expedition seeking information about who made leaks beyond the case in Maryland?
That's NPR's David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
Theodore Boutros is with us now to talk more about this. He is an attorney who has represented many news organizations and matters involving the First Amendment. And I do want to note that his clients include NPR in its case challenging the Trump administration's executive order defunding NPR and PBS. Mr. Boutros, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
How unusual is this?
This is extraordinarily unusual. Very few examples of search warrants being executed on reporters, let alone at their homes, under these circumstances. So it's a dramatic escalation of the Trump administration's war on the press.
Other administrations have subpoenaed journalists. I think people who follow these things will have remembered, you know, one or two cases like this. But how is this different in your view?
This is different because they decided to use a search warrant. It takes it to a whole new level. With a search warrant, the government can come to your house and execute the search warrant and take all your, if you're a reporter, your work product, your source information, your notes, sweep up your computers without the reporter having the ability to challenge that in the first place. With a subpoena, you get the subpoena and then you can go to court before anything is produced. So it's really a radical escalation of the government using its authority to intrude on journalism when they go with the search warrant route. That's what's so rare about this.
Do reporters have any special protections from searches by the government? I mean, I guess my question is, in your view, was any law or regulation broken in this search?
Yes. Based on what we've heard, we're getting information from the Washington Post and from other sources. The law seems to have been broken here. There are several protections specific to reporters. The First Amendment imposes special protections on top of the Fourth Amendment. The Supreme Court, in a case called Zurcher v. Stanford Daily back in 1978, said there's not an absolute bar to search warrants executed on reporters, but they must be done with scrupulous exactitude, so a more rigorous standard. After that, in 1980, Congress passed the Privacy Protection Act to impose more protections, saying that unless the reporter is the target, the suspect of a crime, generally there can't be search warrants executed on reporters. And then the Justice Department has its own guidelines that seem not to have been followed here. So I think this is a real problem. It's extraordinary. It's very, very troubling.
The Washington Post says the Justice Department informed them that the reporter is not accused of any wrongdoing, was not the target of the search, but rather that they are pursuing a government contractor whom they say illegally leaked classified information.
Based on that, it would seem to be a clear violation of Congress's mandate in the Privacy Protection Act. It's inexplicable.
There is no law, as I understand it, barring journalists from publishing or reporting on classified information. But now that the DOJ has her computers and phone, is the journalist exposed to other risks?
That's the danger, both journalistic risks. The government has significant amounts, it sounds like, a work product of the journalist, potential source information. And you never know what prosecutors might do with information once they have it. The Post and the journalists do have the ability to file a motion to get the material back because it violated the law when they seized it. So we'll see how that plays out. But yes, there are all sorts of risks, including to the journalist's First Amendment rights, but also just as a citizen who's had private papers taken from them, apparently in violation of a clear congressional statute and the First Amendment.
And before I let you go, I'm sure there are some people who are listening to our conversation who just think, you know, so what? I'm not a journalist, or who see journalists as just another set of partisans. What might you say to them?
I would say to them that journalists are doing the work for the public. That's why the First Amendment imposes these protections for journalists. It's not for the individual journalist. It's really for the American people so they can get the information they need to put a check on government abuses and to elect the people who they think will do the best job running the country. So it's really a broader point for all of us, not for the individual journalist. And it's really an important issue.
That's Theodore Boutros. He is a partner in the Los Angeles office of Gibson Dunn. He is NPR's lawyer in its First Amendment case against the Trump administration, challenging the administration's executive order defunding NPR and PBS. Mr. Boutros, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
And I do want to mention that we have asked the Department of Justice to hear from one of their spokespeople this morning. To this point, they have not yet responded.
2025 was one of the hottest years on record, according to both federal and international scientists. That means the planet is on the brink of a crucial climate change threshold. Here's NPR's Lauren Sommer.
Officially, 2025 is taking third place. It's the third hottest year globally on average, going back to the Industrial Revolution. That makes it part of a concerning trend, says Samantha Burgess. She's deputy director of the Copernicus Climate Change Service, which monitors climate for the European Union.
The last 3 years, in particular, have been extremely warm compared to earlier years. These 3 years stand apart from those that came before.
2024 still holds the top spot as the hottest on record because it had some extra heat. There was an El Niño, a natural cycle that raises temperatures globally. But 2025 wasn't an El Niño year, and it's still top three, according to federal scientists. Burgess says that shows the clear impact of climate change.
The primary reason for these record temperatures is the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, dominated by the burning of fossil fuels.
Those temperatures brought some big impacts. There was a record amount of heat in the oceans. Sea ice in the Arctic was at the lowest level ever recorded last March, when it's supposed to peak. And snow cover in the Northern Hemisphere was the third lowest recorded.
You know, it's not surprising. The science is very unequivocal about this.
Carlos Martinez is a senior scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, an environmental nonprofit. He says 2025 almost hit 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, which is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a key number because countries have agreed to try to limit warming to that level under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Beyond that, research shows that storms, hurricanes, and heat waves get even more intense.
We haven't, though, reached that threshold in a long-term trend basis, but we're heading in that direction.
The Trump administration is pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The White House did not respond to questions about the temperature records. The last 11 years have been the hottest years since the Industrial Revolution, according to federal climate researchers. International scientists say that's highly likely to continue, with the world passing 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of the decade. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Listening to Morning Edition here on People Powered Radio, KAXE. I'm Kari Hedlund. Good morning. It is a dark morning outside and is going to present some occasional snow showers today. Might see some accumulation in the northeastern part of our listening area. Temperatures today will be around 19 to 32 degrees, much warmer on the western portion of the state. Currently, Brainerd and Grand Rapids at 7 degrees, Hibbing at 2 degrees, Bemidji 10, Aiken at 9, and Park Rapids also at 7 degrees. Tonight, evening lows around 13 to 23 degrees with some more snow possible. We received support from Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, helping guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. More at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com. And support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for services, businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Next weekend, join us for the KBXC-presented Skipalooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji from noon to 3. Come cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. Bring a snack to share, and you can find out more information about that event on our Facebook page. There's an event there with the information there for you. Coming up today, we will be learning from National Native News. We also have a bright spot with Joshua Jones coming up during the 8 o'clock hour and a conversation with Adam Bonahan. He was a voice contestant and will be performing at the Rife Center this weekend. Right now it's time for our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin.
Gone fishing.
Babu, 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 babu.
There's a sign up on your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boy, you bother me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing,
bapa, baby, bapa, bapa,
oh yeah.
You know that sound. That sound means we are having our conversation with our early bird fishing guide, which you hear right here on KAXE Thursday mornings. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
How are we doing this morning?
Okay. I'm sitting here. I'm doing my homework, trying to gather my thoughts to figure out where we should start this whole thing. There's been so much going on in the last week. Mostly it's all going on paper. I haven't been out on the ice myself too much. A lot of people are asking me about it. But for some reason or another, the meeting season and administrative stuff is kind of like been brought to the forefront for a little while here. So
sure.
We're working our way towards the ice ourselves. But for the time being, I'm just trying to stay on top of all the other little developments that are going on out there.
Well, let's maybe start with that paperwork. You mentioned to me something about a big announcement that the DNR either has made or is making.
Yeah, well, the really big one, and this is, a lot of folks are going to say, oh, man, he's not going to talk about this again, but this is it. Okay, this is it. This is the big, if you don't do anything right now, then you will never have a chance. I checked it all out. The statewide walleye limit, the DNR has finally decided that they are going to go for it, and this is the final phase of it now. They've announced their intention to change the rules. There's a public process that's going to it's going to allow dedicated folks to submit comments, but they're going to make you work for it. There's not going to be any little quick, easy link, no survey to take, no push this red button and add your comments to somebody else's page or what have you. They're going to make you either call by phone and tell them what's on your mind, or they're going to ask you to send an email, or, which I think is a dying art, you can send a U.S. mail letter if you want to sit down and write something out and put it in an envelope and mail it. You can do that too. And the long story short, they're going to propose that the statewide walleye limit goes from 6 fish down to 4, and the possession limit will remain at 4. They're not going to leave it at 6 or 8 or anything or any other version of it. So effectively, they're saying your possession limit as of the beginning of the 2027 fishing season is going to change to 4 fish, and it doesn't make any difference what lake you fish on. That's going to be the statewide rule. Now, some of the lakes in certain regions, there's still provisions for special regulations or experimental regulations. If the fisheries manager in your area sees a reason on a given lake that the limit should vary from that 4 fish, they may do it. Red Lake would be an exception. Sometimes they move that limit around according to what the fish population assessments are. So there could be a special regulation of a lower amount. I can't see a situation where anybody would ever say, well, this lake has to have a special regulation to have a larger bag limit. But I suppose anything's possible. That could happen someplace along the line. And I know we've talked an awful lot about this before. They could have gotten me pretty easy to accept the daily limit, a reduction in that. In fact, we've talked about that before. From my perspective, if you lowered my daily limit to 1 fish or 2 fish or something like that, it would have no negative impact on my life because I have easy access to fish. I can go out. I'm pretty confident that I could catch at least enough to eat on most outings. So there's no real stress in my life. What I think the proposal does, though, it discriminates against people who don't have a lot of time to fish, or they have to travel long distance to fish. They don't have technology. We're out with our families, and it's a relatively casual fishing trip. One time we happened to get into some walleyes, and we're traveling back to Texas or Illinois or name a state, someplace that you may be visiting from, and you have the opportunity, once a year or maybe once every so often to gather 6 walleyes and bring them home. And for the last 70 years, the walleye limit at 6 fish has given those folks an opportunity, if they can get into them, if they can catch them, to bring home 6 fish. Now, contrast that with somebody that can fish every weekend. Mm-hmm. And this is the group of people who is really driving this. Higher level skilled anglers that possess a lot of fishing technology, they understand how to catch fish. And the way their mind works is they can do it, every other human being can do it. So one of the things that's been interesting to me, this ties into other meetings that we've had lately. Last week we talked a little bit about the WinFig or the Winnie working group meeting that we had here in the Grand Rapids Fisheries, and they had introduced the results of a survey, an angler survey. A little over 1,000 people participated in it, and we'll talk more in the weeks to follow. But the general kind of thrust of this survey, anglers are accepting of the concept of a lower limit, but they still want to harvest fish to bring home and eat. And there is quite a large proportion of people that while they're accepting of a lower limit, they're not accepting of catching fewer fish. So what they're saying is they want to catch a lot more fish. They release them. So in their mind, the release of those fish makes them better people than people who want to harvest those fish and bring them home. So we're pitting two groups of people against each other here. And so now, instead of having Jeff Sundin on board and supporting the four fish limit, I'm afraid that I have to oppose it, because I really think that possession limit should not have been changed. And I think there's a lot of people that probably feel the way that I do about it. Like I said, if you believe that, if that's the point of view you've got, you're going to have to either email, send a mail, or make a phone call in order to voice your opinion between now and March 31st. That's the end of the comment period, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen by that date. So I'll make sure. I've already posted it a couple of days ago. It's fairly easy to find the contact information on my website now, but I'll put out a periodic reminder, and we'll take it from there. And if you don't mind me just kind of going on here and just keep moving.
Sure. I just had one quick question on that whole limit front, Jeff, and this may be a little bit of an obvious question, but is there reasoning when they release these new limits, do they tie it into, you know, because the numbers of walleye are down, this is our reasoning behind the change in limits? Like, do they give any sort of explanation or to the general public?
This is one of the problems with this. There's a publication, internal publication, a list of talking points that goes from the higher ups at the DNR out to all of their fisheries managers. And they have a rule within the DNR called respect the process. And in other words, if you work for the DNR and there's a rule change coming, you're not allowed to really, you can't go outside of the circus tent and conduct your own little hearing on it. You got to follow the company line, right? So if you want to talk to fisheries biologists, you have to catch the ones that have retired and don't have any reason to fear repercussion, you know, or, you know, career limiting things that can influence the way somebody would think. So fisheries biologists will point, and they have for as long as I can remember, scientific information is not available to support this.
Okay.
The term that they're using is a proactive, while we understand that everything is okay. Now, just to put this in perspective, the first time that I ever wrote about this proposal was in March of 2008. So we're talking about 18 years. This has been going on, this debate. Now, every single walleye that they sought to protect in 2008, all of them, 100% of those fish are dead.
Yeah.
They're all gone. And somehow we're still catching fish. And the comments that you hear from folks over the last, let's say, 8 to 10 years, most people agree that the quality of walleye fishing has not declined, and you'll find a lot of people that will say that it's better than it ever has been. So the fishery, any kind of a being able to point to damage or a decline or so on and so forth, that does not exist. What does exist is this sentiment that there's too much technology, too much social media, the angler skills are becoming more proficient all the time. And so as a precaution against the fishing getting bad, we're going to make this proactive move right now. And this is one of the unintended consequences for the DNR fisheries folks is now they've opened up the door. If there is such a thing as a public sentiment about to try and do something about something, fishing technology is on the tip of everybody's tongue.
Sure.
And there is very easy to find people that would like to see some limitations on the use of the forward fishing, forward facing sonar. And so now we've opened the bag. The term proactive is out there. And so once the DNR has decided that they're going to do something based on a proactive measure, now we might just as well do everything on a proactive measure. And I was at the DNR roundtable this past Friday, and they had a Q&A going on. Rob Gieslein from Outdoor News was interviewing three state legislators. And one of the questions came up about forward-facing sonar, and Josh Heinzman, representative from the Nisswa area, he said something that was really interesting. This is the roundtable. There's 400 people, a pretty high level, you know, everybody from the DNR commissioner on down to just us guys, you know, just people that like to fish. And Heinzman says, we might just as well stop talking about forward-facing sonar, because in 2 years you won't even remember it because of stuff that's coming out and is going to become available. And so, but he left it at that. He didn't keep going on. He didn't elaborate on it. So after the next time there was a little break in the action, I tracked him down and I asked him, I said, you know, when you made that comment about the forward sonar, it made it sound like you know something. And he said, I do. And he told me what it was, and I went and looked it up. So let's talk about the next level. It's called OmniSonar. Have you heard of that yet?
I have not.
Okay. The capabilities of OmniSonar is that it shows you everything that's happening 360 degrees around your entire boat, live time. And it has the capability of showing you schools of fish 1,000 to 1,500 feet away from the boat. So think about sitting in a boat. You've got the distance of a football field in every direction. And if there's fish in that football field, you can see them on your sonar.
Wow.
Right. Now, that sounds like some kind of a futuristic Elon Musk. This is going to happen when we land on Mars, right?
Yeah.
No.
I mean, cars have it to right some now degree. I mean, much smaller radius, but, right, you know, some yep of those cameras.
Yep. I looked it up. I don't really want to make it sound like a commercial for a brand name, but it is it's a unit for about $5,000. You can buy it tomorrow morning if you want to. So it's already, like I said, the cat's out of the bag, the technology part of this, and, you know, the little, if we are going to reduce the walleye limit, this little gift of this term proactive, at least now we can take that proactive and apply it to some of these other things, because this is what's really driving the argument. And I happen to notice on one of the Facebook posts by somebody, they were talking about it, and someone said, well, the reason you need to reduce the limit is because there's too much technology. And so my thought is, well, why would you make everybody that doesn't use this limit pay the price? You know, if folks are fishing from a red rowboat without any electronics, why should they have to settle for a fewer amount of fish so that somebody that's got a $200,000 outfit can go out there and catch all the fish they want to under the guise of, you know, I'm a good person because I'm catching and releasing, even though there are other considerations, hooking mortality and which fish you're targeting and so on and so forth. So it's going to get, the debate is going to keep on moving. We have a meeting of the technology work group coming up now next week. So that will be, we'll try to tie all these things into one big discussion, but I have some ideas, and I'm not really a spokesman for the group, so I'm not gonna really say what I think I'm gonna talk to the group about next week. But we'll see if it gets a little bit of approval. I do have some ideas that would help along these lines, and so it's going to be an ongoing discussion. So,
well, it's just kind of interesting to think we can move on here, but it's just kind of interesting to think how these rules around technology and regulations around technology are truly impacting every industry. You know, you think fishing and hunting are their own thing, and we've talked about the technology within fishing before, but just kind of interesting to think that we're sort of having this new phase in our society of needing to figure out what our boundaries are around all this technology that's changing very quickly. Yep,
the term fair chase has been, that was one of the topics at the round table, one of the sessions that I attended last Friday. And fair chase, the concept and rulemaking process is on hunting is all, it's been going on for a long time. Fishing hasn't really had to deal with it because just these last 5-6 years, the technology has finally taken fishing to the point where you have to start asking the question, you know, what is fair chase? Is going out and seeing a fish 1,000 feet away and driving over and tracking it down and catching that fish, is that fair to the entire angling public? Or is it just fair to the person who knows how to do it? So we're going to have to, well, like I say, it's going to get to be a long, drawn-out conversation, but it has to happen. And I've said before, I know folks have laughed at me when I've said it before, but I can see the day coming when my job is totally obsoleted by technology. You'll be able to pull up to a marina, you'll put your credit card into a kiosk, and they'll point you to the slip where your rental boat is. You'll get in the rental boat, input a few bits of information about what it is you want to do, and the AI technology will tell you, this is the order, this is the 12 spots you're going to fish today, this is the tackle you're going to use. The boat will steer you to the location and keep the speed correct for you, and so on and so forth. And I'll just be sitting on the dock looking out there like a grumpy old codger saying, look at that. Remember when we used to have to go do that? Yeah. Anyway, we'll see. Hopefully I'll live long enough to actually be able to say that. But if I do, I fully expect to see that.
Sounds boring to me. All right, Jeff, let's move on here. Do you want to talk about the fish hatcheries or the trout fishing to wrap up?
I think we should wrap up with trout fishing because it sounds like a lot more fun, and it's starting. The inland lakes are starting this weekend, so if you want to test your skill at catching a stream out through the ice, Saturday is the opening of the season, and any lake now. If you're inside the boundary waters, that season has been going now for a couple weeks. But now any lake in the state, any trout lake, will be open outside of the boundary waters beginning this Saturday. So that includes a lot of these small, everybody, Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Aiken, Hill City. There's lakes, small trout lakes, that are basically put and take fisheries. The DNR stocks fish in them. And the reason they stock them in is to be utilized. And it's really quite popular, the early part of the season especially. It's a busy weekend coming up. Stream trout fishing, rainbows, brook trout. Some lakes have got Kamloops rainbows in them. Some lakes have got brown trout. They're actually not very difficult to catch. The one thing that's a little more tricky than others is most of these lakes are designated trout lakes, so you have to drill your hole with a hand auger, you have to walk in, you can't use motorized vehicles and so on and so forth. But there's a lot of them that are pretty easy to access. It's not hard, and we don't have a lot of snow cover, so I think this would be a pretty easy weekend to get around. Basic tackle, things that you've already got, for walleye fishing or even some of your pan fishing, crappie lures and so on and so forth, are perfectly great for catching these stream trout. And then lake trout obviously is open also. Don't think you have to get really geared up too much for most of the lake trout. The inland lakes in Minnesota that have got lake trout are not mostly lakes where you go and have gigantic, you know, you're not going to be looking for 30 or 40 pound lake trout. So the same tackle, maybe just to gear it up just a little bit, you know, just a medium heavy, a little bit heavier rod, 10 pound or 12 pound test on it, and somewhat larger lures, a white tube, a 3 or 4 inch white tube with a jig head stuffed inside of it is a good lure. That you really can't go wrong with that. Otherwise, any of the flashy spoons, 1/8 ounce, 1/4 ounce flashy spoons will do the job on lake trout too. And if you want it a little bit easier to figure out where to go and do this, a couple years ago I published a link to some maps that show you where the designated trout lakes and streams are, and I'll put that up on the Fishing Report. It will, if it's not up today, it will be up no later than tomorrow morning, so you can check out the website and find those maps of the trout lakes from there.
That is Early Bird Fishing Guide Jeff Sundin. Find more at jeffsundin.com. Thanks, Jeff. Good luck trout fishing this weekend if you get out.
Thank you. See you next week.
See you next week. This is the KAXE Morning Show. I'm Kari Hedlund. Jennifer Barr is joining me in just a moment here. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A team from the Canadian military has arrived at a Northern Manitoba First Nation, which is dealing with a severe water crisis. One of the reserve's water treatment plants has been out of commission for 2 weeks after a power outage. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
The power was out for days after a power line that ran between two islands on the Nelson River broke. Although power was restored after a couple of days, the outage resulted in frozen water systems, sewer backups, electrical issues, and burst pipes. About 4,400 residents were displaced after the reserve declared a state of emergency. Pimichikamak is more than 300 miles north of Winnipeg. The chief, David Monias, says a 7-member military team from the Joint Operational Support Group based in Kingston, Ontario, has arrived and will provide technical assistance and support related to critical infrastructure.
The Army, with their engineers and their logistics people, are going to be taking a look at the... They're doing a site tour on the water plant right now. Take notes and identify what needs to be fixed and assess how it needs to be fixed and what resources are required to fix it.
Monias adds that nearly every one of the 1,300 homes in the community will need some kind of repairs. And band counselor Shirley Robinson says having so many people forced out of their homes in midwinter is taking an emotional toll.
Like, they really want to go home. And there's that feeling of displacement, that feeling of isolation, that feeling of that they can't be with their community.
Monias says a second military team is due to arrive on Wednesday. Meanwhile, plumbers and other skilled workers from outside the province are also on their way to Pimichikamak to help with water and electrical issues. And Monias says a U.S. company has reached out about sending a portable water plant to the First Nation. It's not the first time Pimichikamak residents were forced to leave their reserve. Many were forced to go south twice because of wildfires. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Indigenous peoples across the U.S. have been swept up in the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented immigrants. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, an Arizona tribe is taking steps to safeguard its tribal members.
Thank you for calling the Hualapai Tribe's message line, where we encourage you to report any encounters with ICE agents.
The Hualapai Tribe near Kingman has set up a hotline.
Please leave your name and contact information, as well as the date, location, and a brief description of the incident. All information received will be checked and documented by tribal administration.
Hualapai Chairman Dwayne Clark is urging members to remain calm and always carry their tribal ID cards with them. His administration is also pledging to aid its 2,300 members in verifying their identity should they be held by federal authorities. This comes in the aftermath of a fatal shooting by an ICE agent in Minneapolis, also where 4 members of a South Dakota tribe have been detained. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
In the Twin Cities this week, a number of tribes are issuing tribal IDs to their citizens. Tribal leaders have been raising concerns about the safety of their citizens in the area following last week's fatal shooting in Minneapolis. They're encouraging their citizens to carry identification, including tribal IDs. White Earth Nation, Red Lake Nation, Boys Fort Band, Mille Lacs Band, and Leech Lake Band are among tribes holding ID events at their urban offices. Leaders of Native organizations and grassroots groups have been responding to the shooting with community safety plans, as members of the Native community have been reporting interactions with ICE. A community prayer and gathering was held Sunday, and organizers are hosting Know Your Rights events this week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Quahonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. I'm Kari Hedlund here with Jennifer Barr this Thursday morning. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Pretty good.
Doing all right.
Yeah. Huh?
It's dark outside.
It's dark. It has not started snowing yet. You know, earlier in the week, it looked like we were maybe going to get a bit of snow, but now I'm not so sure.
It's possible still. Under the northeastern portion of our listing area is still under a severe weather alert.
Okay.
With snow squalls possible this morning as it moves through northern Minnesota. Possible brief heavy snow and gusty winds. Might see 1 to 3 inches today throughout the day, but it also looks like blowing snow might also be the main issue.
Yeah. Okay.
It's going to be pretty windy today.
Yes. So it definitely could feel like a blizzard for
yes.
times.
And temperatures throughout northern Minnesota too, you know, normally when we do the weather report, it's like a variation of like 5 degrees, mm-hmm. 7 degrees. We have like a 13 point spread between, it's like ranging from 19 degrees to 32 degrees. So it's kind of a widespread. Northwestern Minnesota will be a little bit warmer on the warmer end today. Northeastern and north central on the cooler end. Those winds from the south-southwest, though, between 10 and 20 miles per hour. That snow might continue into tonight and into tomorrow morning. So we'll see as we go through this. Malachi and I are really jonesing for a
nice, fresh,
good,
coat.
Solid amount of snow.
Yeah. It's just been so icy. It's melted, it's frozen, it's kind of treacherous.
It's been a bit gnarly and... yeah, so we'll see. Hopefully, you know, we'd love to know what your winter plans are. We've got our Ski Palooza next Saturday in Bemidji at Three Island Park from noon to 3, where you can come hopefully cross-country ski with us, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music. There's going to be a fire to hang out around. You can also bring a snack to share. That's, again, next Saturday, the 24th, from noon to 3.
Yeah, lots of things planned. I know this weekend, I don't know if you mentioned it with Jeff Sundin, it's Take a Kid Ice Fishing Weekend in Minnesota, where you can fish free if you're with a kid under the age of 15. You don't need a license, and it's just a way to get out there and kind of learn fishing together. And if it's warm enough, I know it is going to get quite a bit colder this weekend. Lake Bemidji State Park is having an event where you can, they're going to have heated shelters and equipment for you to use. So you don't even have to have your own stuff. You can just show up as long as it's warm enough. Again, some things you know, could be dependent on temperatures.
And just a reminder, bring snacks for your kids.
Always.
last time I went ice fishing, I was an adult. And I never like trust other people to bring snacks for me. But for some reason that day I did, there were no snacks and I was out there for like 9.5
Ooh.
Hours. And I was like,
you know,
I get hangry because I do.
Yeah.
Don't leave me without food.
In my limited fishing experience, the best part is always the snacks.
Yeah.
Whether it's summer fishing, winter fishing.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Bring me some
you just
snacks.
Validated me there. Our KAXE question of the week this week is about games. We're wondering what games does your family play? Do you and your partner play, or do you play by yourself? We'd love to hear what board games, card games. We've had lots of really great engagement this week about what people are playing. And, you know, it's sort of an old school thing to sit around and play games. I love it.
I do too.
There are families, though, that are gaming families, and then families that just are not.
Mm-hmm. Try it, though. If you're not a gaming family, yes. Find a simple game, nothing too complicated. Put on some good music.
Yeah.
Snacks again.
Snacks.
And have a good time.
We were just playing one last weekend, Utter Nonsense.
I heard you explain this.
Yes. So you get a card and it says that, you know, like an accent or a voice that you have to use. And then you have to find in your cards which card fits that voice the best. Like, and so then there's a judge and whoever delivers it in the funniest way or in the best way wins for that round. It's hilarious because we played with my sister and we were dying laughing because she's so bad at voices and yeah. accents, and we just didn't know it until we played it. Like, Amy, what is happening?
Yeah.
It's really funny. So we'd love to hear from you. You can text us 218-326-1234. Now it's time for our daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, January 15th in the year 2008, I watch as a single red pole digs a bit at the snow. I wasn't aware of it, but the red poles will often find a roost under the snow, and rightly so, since the outside temperature can be raised nearly 40 to 60 degrees by digging down into the snow and building a little snow cave. The insulation of a foot of snow is quite valuable, and these little red poles are not above using that opportunity to keep themselves warm. They have another trick that allows them to survive these cold winter days, and that is they have a pouch in their throat that they can store seeds in. So they eat during the day, and as they're eating toward the end of the day, they begin to fill this throat pouch with extra seeds. And while they are roosting, whether it be on a branch in a secluded spot or if they have dug themselves a little snow tunnel, wherever they are, they will begin to feed those seeds into their gizzard as they sleep. And the extra energy brought about by those seeds will keep them active through the night.
This list on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows Thursday through Saturday, January 15th through the 17th in Aiken, Grand Rapids, and Park Rapids. First up, Rich Madsen and Jermaine Gemberling are playing a duo show at Sampaguita in Aiken Thursday at 6 o'clock. The Musical and Life Partners are getting ready to release another Rich Madsen and the North Stars album next month, and their duo shows are largely acoustic affairs, digging into their deep catalog of songs. It's Rich and Jermaine this Thursday at Sampaguita in Aiken. We're sticking in Aiken for Charlie Parr at the Ripple Center Friday at 6 p.m. The beloved folk blues artist sold out the venue the last time he visited and will be sure to draw a large crowd again. His most recent release was a novel called Five last year. Opening the show are Duluth-based Water Cats, who blend French pop and folk. Charlie Parr at the Ripple Center this Friday. Also Friday night, Americana and folk singer-songwriter Charlie Wagner is playing at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 7 p.m. Wagner released the Finding Home album last year with an accompanying multimedia book. And after this show, we'll have a book tour throughout northern Minnesota. It's Charlie Wagner this Friday night at Rapids Brewing. Finally, Corey Medina and Brothers are playing the Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids Saturday night at 7 p.m. The Medina-led electric blues quartet are rounded out by Gary Brusty on bass, Rock Bolio on second guitar, and Eric Sundin on drums. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
That is the set list, which you hear each week on KAXE. You can always, as Malachi said, send us your music, live music announcements to music@kaxe.org. This is the Thursday morning show. I'm Kari Hedlund here with Jennifer Barr.
Support for KAXE comes from Lady Sippers N.A. Bottle Shop in downtown Deer River, Itasca County's only N.A. bottle shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info at ladysippers.com. And we thank the Bonner Eye Clinic, introducing Dr. Abby Spur to their team at both locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, performing routine eye exams, assisting with post-op care after surgery, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly.
North Central Small Business Development Center invites current and aspiring small business owners to the Entrepreneurs on Tap Learning Series Wednesdays at Last Turn Brew Pub in Brainerd at 5 o'clock. There's a different topic each month now through May. Find a full schedule at northcentralsbdc.com.
Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org.
This is 91.7.